couldn't find a terrorist if he advertised on a billboard, "Teddy, happy fishing, you'll get even fewer trout than votes. Morgan, why didn't you just die like everyone promised me you would? Teddy, presidents come and go, but I never leave. Morgan, it was Kritz who wanted to keep you. Thank him for your job. I wanted to sack your ass 2 weeks after my inauguration." Kritz said loudly, "Coffee, anyone?" Teddy said, "No." And as soon as that was established, Hovey and Priddy likewise declined. And because the CIA wanted no coffee, President Morgan said, "Yes, black with two sugars." Kritz nodded at a secretary who was waiting in a half-open side door. He turned back to the gathering and said, "We don't have a lot of time." Teddy said quickly, "I'm here to discuss Joel Backman." "Yes, that's why you're here," the president said. "As you know," Teddy continued, almost ignoring the president, "Mr. Backman went to prison without saying a word. He still carries some secrets that, frankly, could compromise national security." "You can't kill him," Kritz blurted. "We cannot target American citizens, Mr. Kritz. It's against the law. We prefer that someone else do it."
"I don't follow," the president said.
"Here's the plan. If you pardon Mr. Backman, and if he accepts the pardon, then we will have him out of the country in a matter of hours. He must agree to spend the rest of his life in hiding. This should not be a problem because there are several people who would like to see him dead, and he knows it. We'll relocate him to a foreign country, probably in Europe, where he'll be easier to watch. He'll have a new identity. He'll be a free man. And with time, people will forget about Joel Backman."
"That's not the end of the story," Kritz said.
"No. We'll wait, perhaps a year or so. Then we'll leak the word in the right places. They'll find Mr. Backman, and they'll kill him. And when they do so, many of our questions will be answered."
A long pause, as Teddy looked at Kritz, then the president. When he was convinced they were thoroughly confused, he continued,
"It's a very simple plan, gentlemen. It's a question of who kills him."
"So you'll be watching?" Kritz asked.
"Very closely."
"Who's after him?" the president asked. Teddy refolded his veiny hands and recoiled a bit. Then he looked down his long nose like a schoolteacher addressing his little third graders.
"Perhaps the Russians, the Chinese, maybe the Israelis. There could be others."
Of course there were others. But no one expected Teddy to reveal everything he knew. He never had, never would, regardless of who was president, and regardless of how much time he had left in the Oval Office. They came and went, some for 4 years, others for 8. Some loved the espionage, others were only concerned with the latest polls. Morgan had been particularly inept at foreign policy, and with a few hours remaining in his administration, Teddy certainly was not going to divulge any more than was necessary to get the pardon.
"Why would Backman take such a deal?" Kritz asked.
"He may not," Teddy answered. "But he's been in solitary confinement for 6 years. That's 23 hours a day in a tiny cell. 1 hour of sunshine, 3 showers a week, bad food. They say he's lost 60 pounds. I hear he's not doing too well."
2 months ago, after the landslide, when Teddy Maynard conceived this pardon scheme, he had pulled a few of his many strings, and Backman's confinement had grown much worse. The temperature in his cell was lowered 10 degrees, and for the past month he had had a terrible cough. His food, bland at best, had been run through the processor again and was being served cold. His toilet flushed about half the time. The guards woke him up at all hours of the night. His phone privileges were curtailed. The law library that he used twice a week was suddenly off limits. Backman, a lawyer, knew his rights, and he was threatening all manner of litigation against the prison and the government, though he had yet to file suit. The fight was taking its toll. He was demanding sleeping pills and Prozac.
"You want me to pardon Joel Backman so you can arrange for him to be murdered?" the president asked.
"Yes,"
Teddy said bluntly. But we won't actually arrange it.
But it'll happen.
Yes.
And his death will be in the best interests of our national security?
I firmly believe that.
Chapter 2. The isolation wing at Rudley Federal Correctional Facility had 40 identical cells, each a 12-foot square with no windows, no bars, green-painted concrete floors, and cinder-block walls, and a door that was solid metal with a narrow slot at the bottom for food trays and a small open peephole for the guards to have a look occasionally. The wing was filled with government informants, drug snitches, mafia misfits, a couple of spies, men who needed to be locked away because there were plenty of folks back home who would gladly slice their throats. Most of the 40 inmates in protective custody at Rudley had requested the I-wing. Joel Backman was trying to sleep when two guards clanged open his door and switched on his light. The warden wants you, one said, and there was no elaboration. They rode in silence in a prison van across the frigid Oklahoma prairie, past other buildings holding less secure criminals, until they arrived at the administration building. Backman, handcuffed for no apparent reason, was hurried inside, up two flights of stairs, then down a long hall to the big office where lights were on and something important was going down. He saw a clock on the wall. It was almost 11 p.m. He had never met the warden, which was not at all unusual. For many good reasons, the warden didn't circulate. He wasn't running for office, nor was he concerned with motivating the troops. With him were three other suits, all earnest-looking men who had been chatting for some time. Though smoking was strictly prohibited in offices owned by the U.S. government, an ashtray was full, and a thick fog hung close to the ceiling. With absolutely no introduction, the warden said,
"Sit over there, Mr. Backman."
"A pleasure to meet you," Backman said as he looked at the other men in the room. "Why exactly am I here?"
"We'll discuss that."
"Could you please remove these handcuffs? I promise not to kill anyone."
The warden snapped at the nearest guard, who quickly found a key and freed Backman. The guard then scrambled out of the room, slamming the door behind him, much to the displeasure of the warden, a very nervous man. He pointed and said,
"This is Special Agent Adair of the FBI. This is Mr. Kanabe from the Justice Department, and this is Mr. Sizemore, also from Washington."
None of the three moved in the direction of Mr. Backman, who was still standing and looking quite perplexed. He nodded at them in a half-hearted effort to be polite. His efforts were not returned.
"Please sit," the warden said, and Backman finally took a chair. "Thank you. As you know, Mr. Backman, a new president is about to be sworn in. President Morgan is on his way out. Right now, he is in the Oval Office wrestling with the decision of whether to grant you a full pardon."
Backman was suddenly seized with a violent cough, one brought on in part by the near Arctic temperature in his cell, and in part by the shock of the word pardon. Mr. Kanabe from Justice handed him a bottle of water, which he gulped and splashed down his chin and finally managed to stifle the cough.
"A pardon?"
he mumbled.
"A full pardon, with some strings attached."
"But why?"
"I don't know why, Mr. Backman. Nor is it my business to understand what's happening. I'm just the messenger."
Mr. Sizemore, introduced simply as from Washington, but without the baggage of title or affiliation, said,
"It's a deal, Mr. Backman. In return for a full pardon, you must agree to leave the country, never return, and live with a new identity in a place where no one can find you."
No problem there, thought Backman. He didn't want to be found.
"But why?"
he mumbled again. The bottle of water in his left hand could actually be seen shaking. As Mr. Sizemore from Washington watched it shake, he studied Joel Backman. From his closely cropped gray hair to his battered dime store running shoes, with his black prison-issue socks, and he couldn't help but recall the image of the man in his prior life. A magazine cover came to mind, a fancy photo of a meticulously groomed Joel Backman in a black Italian suit, impeccably tailored and groomed, and looking at the camera with as much smugness as humanly possible.